It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We turn our attention to the Gaza Strip with perspective from Wisconsin Voices. A humanitarian crisis is unfolding as Israel targets Gaza with airstrikes after the Palestinian militant group Hamas executed a shocking attack on Israel this month. President Joe Biden in Israel yesterday.
We have to also bear in mind that Hamas does not represent all the Palestinian people. And it has brought them only suffering.
Courtesy of CNN, calling at any point with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lorraine Halinka-Malko is a coordinator of Jewish Voice for Peace Milwaukee and co-founder of the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine, also an associate professor at UW-Milwaukee's Zilber School of Public Health. Lorraine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. We also have Janan Najib, executive director of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition and founder of the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine. Janan, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Janan, I understand you were instrumental in putting together this new coalition of Wisconsin-based Muslim and Jewish organizations. Why form the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine with several other groups?
Well, actually, it's not just Muslim and Jewish. In fact, probably a large number of the participants are Christian, atheists, variety of different faiths. There are more than 30 organizations already, although we only formed, you know, just about a week ago. I think the factor that really encouraged us to come together was the very lopsided presentation of the news media, particularly the national news media, Congress, our president, on the issue of Palestine and on the people of regarding the people of Gaza. Very lopsided coverage, very lopsided narrative, and we felt that what's not presented are really the many, many people in the United States that understand the conflict and understand this was not an unprovoked event. This came after years and years of provocation by Israel. You know, the narrative completely excluded the oppression and dispossession and constant assault on the Palestinians in Gaza. And we came together really to sort of be a voice for these individuals that had been marginalized and silenced.
Turning to your family, you have family living in the West Bank, one of the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. How concerned are you for their safety?
Well, I'm extremely concerned because my mother is there. I have uncles there. I have an aunt there. I have many cousins there and their children that are there. And so it's of grave concern, particularly because as the assault on Gaza started, there's been a total blackout on what's been happening in the West Bank. There was no music festival in the West Bank. The West Bank didn't do anything yet. What Israel has done is isolated every city and town and village from each other. They have bulldozed roads that and blockaded roads that go from one village to another, and they depend on each other. So basically schools and people, you know, working, everything is at a standstill. And they have armed these Jewish settlers who are supported by the army to basically really keep watch over these villages and these towns. And in some areas, people are afraid to even leave their homes. And these are societies where every day they go out to buy, you know, their food, their bread, especially because Israel constantly turns off electricity, even in the West Bank, it turns off water. And so they have to go out every day. And yet this is something that is not being mentioned. And within this last week alone, alone, there have been close to 100 individuals in the West Bank that have been shot dead. Most of them are young children, there have been more than 1,500 injured, yet the news is not covering that. That's not Hamas. They did not attack Israel, but this is the part of the ethnic cleansing that has been taking place for 75 years that is just unfortunately ignored by our Congress, ignored by our government, ignored by mainstream media, yet the entire world knows it. We're the only ones that seem to be clueless. And so we go to the United Nations Security Council and we veto humanitarian aid, and we're the only ones that are vetoing humanitarian aid. It's absurd. It's absurd.
Turning to Lorraine Hilenka Malko, your involvement in Jewish Voice for Peace dates back nearly a decade. What unites your group with the other organizations in this new coalition as it responds to the war between Israel and Hamas?
Well, Jewish Voice for Peace is a Jewish national grassroots organization that's working towards Palestinian freedom and Judaism beyond Zionism. And it's the largest such organization in the world. We are Jews who believe passionately in Palestinian freedom and that all life is precious. So we strive for a future where all people can live in freedom and safety. And we joined the coalition so that we could work with others here in Milwaukee towards those goals, towards the goals of Palestinian liberation and freedom and safety for everyone.
We're talking about the war between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas with founders of the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine, Lorraine Hilenka Malko, Janan Najib with us. You can join in the conversation, your questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Lorraine, President Biden yesterday flew to Tel Aviv, where he met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and emphasized American support for Israel. What could Biden's visit to the region accomplish?
I am not sure what it could accomplish because it ended up being very one-sided. He was only meeting with, not completely under his, you know, not completely his fault. Other people withdrew, but he was only meeting with Israel. And what I think he should have done is he should have insisted that the Israeli government stop the mass genocide of Palestinians. So I think what it could accomplish or what it should have accomplished is that Israel stopped dropping bombs on innocent civilians in Gaza, and that they open humanitarian corridors. So right now you have over 2 million people in Gaza, half of whom are children, and most of them have no water. The water has run out. People are drinking contaminated water. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm a public health faculty member. People who drink contaminated water, you can very likely, it can lead to mass outbreaks of cholera, of typhoid fever, which is deadly on its own, even without the bombing. So you have over 2 million civilians who are trapped, completely trapped in Gaza, half of whom were told to move from one part of the country to the other after it had been bombed, so they could only do it on foot. And it's just an absolutely horrendous humanitarian situation. And Biden should have done everything he could have to stop it, and he didn't.
That is Lorraine Hilenka Malko and Janan Najib. They're leaders of the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine. As we examine this time of deep suffering of Palestinians and Israelis with Wisconsin perspectives, call in with a question. You can share your views at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. President Biden in Israel Wednesday, pledging support to Israelis and humanitarian assistance to suffering Palestinians. We examine the latest war between Israel and Hamas with Wisconsin Views. Janann Najib with us and Lorraine Halinka-Malko, co-founders of the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts in this discussion. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good morning. Good topic. And when you look at the history of that region of the world, my whole life, I'm in my 60s, my whole life I've heard about news in the Middle East. And my question is very simple. When you look at the history, why don't the Arab nations receive the Palestinians as refugees, or why don't the Palestinians just assimilate into Arab nations?
Janann, can you field that question?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, when Europe decided after the Holocaust that they wanted to get rid of their Jewish problem, and so they wanted to create a European colonialist state in the middle of the Middle East, the process of creating Israel led into the dispossession. And the refugee status of nearly a million Palestinians who ended up in Lebanon, they ended up in Jordan, they ended up in Egypt. Many of them still in refugee camps. These are small countries. So I think that's a very interesting question. Why should the Arab world have to deal with the racism and the brutal policies of Israel? Israel's goal is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, and they want them to disappear and become the problem of someone else so that they can have the entire country of Palestine, which, by the way, is in violation of all international law. That's not how the United Nations divided Palestine. And so basically, it's kind of like, yeah, you go ahead and become somebody else's problem. I think that's a little bit almost racist to say that somebody else should take care of the Arabs and the Palestinians should just get up and leave their country. That's like someone saying, you know what, I like your house, let me just come sit in your house, and that's okay, go live with your relative somewhere else. These are the indigenous people of the land. These are the indigenous people of the country. But this is kind of the same story that we always see with colonialist powers. They go in and they try to really control and dispossess the indigenous peoples, and then they want them to become somebody else's problem. Even now you hear, you know, Israel saying, well, you know, even Egypt doesn't want them, the Arabs don't want them. Excuse me, they learned this 75 years ago with the original Nakba, because those Palestinians were never allowed back into their country. And so they don't want to be part of this ethnic cleansing campaign. This issue is the responsibility of Israel and the Israeli-backed U.S. Congress and government that is controlled by spokespeople and mouthpieces for Israel that have consistently allowed this kind of oppression and dispossession to take place. And I'm sorry, we stand alone in the world. We stand alone in this kind of stand. The vast majority of the world, and you can see it with the protests that are taking all over the world, with the votes in the United Nations, with the votes on the Security Council, we stand alone. Why is it that we are so clueless as to what's happening over there? No, this is the land of the Palestinians. The Palestinians have every right to remain in their land. The European settlers that are coming from the United States and from Russia and from Europe, they're the ones that belong in Europe. They're not the ones that belong on Palestinian land.
Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan on Monday joined dozens of other House Democrats urging President Biden to secure for Palestinians in Gaza access to daily necessities. And Pocan told C-SPAN that Israel must agree to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza.
They have to restore food and water and fuel, because right now it's, again, collective punishment to the people in Gaza. And we have to make sure that we're providing substantial humanitarian assistance, both to Israel, but more so to the Palestinians in Gaza, because they just don't have the resources.
Lorraine, on Wednesday in Israel, Biden announced an agreement on humanitarian aid had been reached, pledging $100 million in American funding to assist civilians in Gaza and the West Bank. How should the U.S. government respond to the new conflict?
So first, I want to say that Biden did not give a timeline for the border crossing opening. And White House spokesman John Kirby said it would occur, quote unquote, in the coming days after road repairs. So the reason for the need for road repairs is because Israel has dropped over 6,000 bombs on Gaza in the course of a week. That is about the equivalent of about a quarter of an atomic bomb. And it is more bombs than were dropped in a full year of the U.S. War in Afghanistan. So the reason the roads are impassable is because of the bombing, which the U.S. has supported. And in the coming days is way too long. We're almost at the point of no return right now. I mean, people are out of water. People are out of food. People have no electricity. I mean, this is absolutely desperate conditions. The humanitarian corridors need to be opened immediately. And Israel controls six of those. I mean, six of those are directly controlled by Israel. They don't have to be coordinated with any other government. Your question was, what should Biden do? I'm sorry, I can't remember now.
Well, the humanitarian assistance to Palestinians, $100 million, is that a step in the direction you wish to go?
Sure. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket of what's needed. So more than one border crossing needs to be opened for humanitarian assistance to come in, and it needs to come in immediately. And the U.S. should be facilitating that to come in, including through the multiple borders that are directly with Israel.
Lorraine Hilenka-Malko with us, Janan Najib. They are the founders of the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine. As we talk about the war between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas, you can join in the conversation. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Ali is here in Franklin. Ali, hi. Hi, Ali. Can you hear us?
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I don't want to mince my words. There is no question that war crimes are being committed in Gaza as we speak. Blockading basic necessities such as food, water, and electricity are blatant human rights violations. Using white phosphorus as a weapon is a war crime. Collective punishment is a war crime. Children are being killed, hospitals are being bombed, and journalists are being killed. When we talk about democracy, humanity, this type of violence is only possible when dehumanization of people is complete in the eyes of perpetrator. When we question why other Arab states should not take the refugees from Palestine, why don't we question why occupation, why annexation, why settlements?
Ali, thanks for calling in. Janan, where does this conflict go from here? What are the prospects for peace, and what would you say to Ali?
Yeah, I completely agree. This is a genocide. These are war crimes under the cover of the United States. We sent our battleships so that to give cover for Israeli war crimes. It's not the first time. I mean, this is well known. You know, where indigenous peoples are being exterminated and genocide is taking place, and we end up on the wrong side of history. I think that what this has guaranteed is that not only is Israel guaranteeing itself to become a pariah in the Middle East forever, and in fact in the world, you can make a agreements with dictators in the Arab world that don't represent the Arab street or the Arab populations and the Muslim populations around the world, as well as all of those countries and those peoples that have ever suffered under colonialist rule and know what colonialism is like. All of these people understand this story. So I think, first of all, Israel it will become a pariah, and the United States has lost all credibility. Honestly, it has lost all credibility. And just going back to the issue of the humanitarian
very quickly,
aid.
We're out of time. Janann, thank you for joining us. Janann Najib, Executive Director of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition. Lorraine Halinka-Malko, Coordinator of Jewish Voice for Peace Milwaukee. They lead the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine. More conversation ahead on this as we go deeper on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Palestinian armed group Hamas stormed from the blockaded Gaza Strip 12 days ago. The United Nations estimating 4,200 people have been killed and over a million people displaced. And this attack coincided with a major Jewish holiday. We examine the intersection of religion and politics in the region with Elizabeth Shachman Hurd, Chair of Religious Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. Be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Beth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's good to be with you.
What could be Hamas's goals for attacking Israel and sparking this latest military conflict?
Well, it's very difficult to speak on behalf of Hamas, but I can make some educated remarks about what we suspect is going on here. There are a couple of factors that we need to consider. First of all, the coming together of Saudi Arabia and some of the other Gulf states with Israel in a possible peace agreement following up on the Abraham Accords is something that is perceived by the Palestinians as extremely threatening to their potential claims in what is now Israel-Palestine. They are very worried that there will be a coming together of these states and that there will be no space left for the Palestinian people any longer. And so this is a moment, a turning point, a moment of extreme fear and extreme oppression of the Palestinians as they start to feel the stranglehold of these very powerful states. And notice they're not all, that these are Muslim majority states in many cases who are allying with Israel. So this is not a religious war. This is a much larger picture that we need to take into account. So they're threatened by that. And the second factor is that the situation in Gaza, as Lorraine and Janann mentioned, is a 16-year stranglehold of the people living in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians there are running out of food, medications, water. Even before the Hamas attack, conditions were dire. They were subject to air raids, frequently much loss of life over the past 16 years. And extremely, extremely oppressed living conditions in which they had very little opportunity not only to find work, but just to survive on a daily basis. We're talking here about an open air prison with Israel controlling the exits and the entrances. And so the people, I think, have reached a point of no return. And there are many Palestinians who would not and do not support the Hamas attacks in Israel, to be clear. And there are also people who feel that they just can't take it any longer. And we're seeing here the blowback for many, many years of Israeli imperialism and Israeli taking of the land and resources of the Palestinian people.
I just want to circle back for a moment to the Abraham Accords and how the U.S. fits into that picture and how the U.S. feels about, you know, the bilateral agreements on Arab-Israeli that the Arab-Israeli signed, and you know, just where the U.S. stands in that.
Great question. So, first of all, the U.S. is a strong supporter of those accords. They were concluded under the Trump administration, and in exchange for just to give you one quick example, to give your listeners a sense of the how much the U.S. supported these agreements, in exchange for Morocco recognizing Israel, the U.S. agreed to Morocco's demand that the U.S. recognize its claims to Western Sahara, which is a contested strip of land. Sounds familiar, right? A contested strip of land on the western and southwestern coast of Morocco. So this is the UN has declared it basically it should be administered internationally until determined, until the people undertake a referendum and determine their own sovereign status. But the U.S. is recognizing Morocco's claim to that land, and with enormous resistance and violence from the people of that southern region, in exchange for Morocco recognizing Israel. So what we're seeing here is big powers playing off each other and using the opportunity, or using the Israel card. If you behave and make friends with Israel, we'll give you what you want and we'll allow you to move forward with whatever you want to do to your own people domestically or in the neighboring areas. So these are very highly contested accords. They're often celebrated. But the reality is that there are a lot of people who are losing out. And many of those people, as your former guest pointed out, don't have much of a voice internationally. The Sahrawi people of Western Sahara, I'd be shocked if most of your listeners had heard of them. They're very similar plight to the Palestinians, and they have very, very little voice on our media, mainstream media channels and networks and conversations. So there is a sense in which you know, we're seeing big power politics play out right before our eyes, and the coming together, the rapprochement, as we say in poli-sci, this coming together of Saudi Arabia and Israel is a major threat to Palestinians. They fear that this could very well be the end of any hope of sovereignty, self-determination, or even a two-state solution, not to mention a democratic one state across the whole region, which would be, in my view, the only long-term solution to this horrific violence that we're seeing today.
Beth Shachman-Hurd giving us context on international relations unfolding in the war between Israel and Hamas. Beth is Northwestern University political science and religious studies professor. You can join in with your questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Lyric in Blanchardville. Lyric, hi. What would you like to bring up?
What I'd like to ask is this, that I remember when George Floyd was being murdered and a group of people watched him being murdered and strangled. To me, it's a small metaphor of what's happening. And I would like to ask the people that are citizens of the U.S. to look at the situation and remember that they're human beings and that it takes courage to speak up. These people that have lived there on their land do not deserve to be murdered slowly by starving to death and being thirsty and being bombed and killed. And are we going to stand and watch and say, oh, that was wrong later, if we feel safe to say that? I'd like us to think about the courage it might take to learn how to heal. And I feel sad that Israel is treating Palestine in many ways the way that their people were treated in the Holocaust. And somehow we need to learn to heal. And I'd like a discussion on how we can heal, all of us, because if we're standing here watching this and not discussing it, we are complicit in the murder of those children and the people. Thank you.
Thank you, Lyric. Beth Hurd, what comes up for you?
Well, I agree, and I empathize, and I applaud this listener for expressing those views. I think that in the climate we're living in right now, it's very easy to be fearful, to say, I don't understand enough about this conflict. I'm not an expert in Middle East politics. I don't want to be perceived as either anti-Muslim or anti-Semitic. I'm neither, and to stay silent. And I think that your caller there is suggesting that staying silent right now is not an option. and that we do need to educate ourselves as best we can with any of the resources we can find. And we need to find a way to voice our concerns to our representatives and to say there needs to be justice, equality. We mourn and we cannot tolerate the loss of innocent lives on either side. And we've got to stop. There has to be a ceasefire and there has got to be a demilitarization of this conflict. I think that the behind the scenes of your caller's comment is also a critique, if I can put words in her mouth, of the military-industrial complex, of all of the interests that are profiting from this conflict. And there are indeed a lot of arms sales that are going on. And there are a lot of people who benefit from the militarization of the conflict in the Middle East. So we need to push back against those interests, which are on our own soil and which are here in the United States and which are in Washington, allegedly speaking for the people. So there needs to be public kind of coming together around opposition to this militarization.
For the past 16 years, as you mentioned, has the blockade helped rally support for Hamas militants within Gaza?
Absolutely, Kate. I think that not only the blockade, but this entire war is, and I should say the Israeli response to the horrific attacks that we saw on October 7th in southern Israel. This response is exactly what Hamas was hoping for. Hamas is now going to be able to rally its troops, to recruit young Palestinian women and men to their cause, to galvanize people and to bring that anger, frustration, grief, to bear on other forms of armed resistance. And I feel that this is really, really something that cannot be emphasized enough, that the more Israel undertakes violence against the Palestinian people, the more the Palestinian people are going to organize violence in return. This is a vicious cycle. It's been going on for many, many years. And we need to dream about other kinds of solutions to this conflict that will allow people, all people in this region, some form of representation, some form of sovereign autonomy, and some form of safety and security in their homelands, in their shared homelands, I should emphasize.
Beth Shachman Hurd, Chair of Religious Studies, Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University, researches the Middle East. Be part of the conversation, calling in with a question. You can share your perspectives, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the complex dynamics of some of the world's major regions in the Gaza Strip, strained by the latest war sparked by Hamas militants ambushing Israeli villages earlier this month. Call in with a question, share your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Beth Shachman Hurd is a professor of religious studies and political science at Northwestern University. Let's take a call now. Reggie in Oshkosh. Reggie, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi. I was just wondering, we can give Israel all these weapons and send carriers out there and all the support, but which they don't need. But meanwhile, we have no real plans to help Ukraine out anymore. And they're still being murdered. And how does that make us as a country in a whole look, where we can just jump around and give some people weapons who need them and some people weapons who don't? And, it's messing everything up.
Reggie, thanks for that question. Beth, go ahead.
Thank you, Reggie. I think it's really important and interesting that you connect these two major challenges right now on the world stage. Indeed, a lot of Americans do support Ukrainian sovereignty in the face of Russian aggression. And it's interesting, given that fact, that they don't seem to make that transfer. Many of them, maybe not listeners to this show, but many of them don't make that transfer over to Gaza and say, oh, let's support the Gazan people against Israeli aggression in the same way as they see their land and resources taken and people being murdered. So this is a really interesting puzzle to think through from the perspective of global politics and American foreign policy. Let me just say, I do think that the idea on the Hill is to introduce legislation that would provide funding to both conflicts, linking them explicitly together so that one could not oppose Israel without also hurting Ukraine. So that's a political tactic and a strategy that I hope Americans will be able to, again, speak to your representatives, say these should be delinked. We are dealing with very different issues here. These are different conflicts. So that is something that's front and center in my mind as we think about the two together in the same breath. The other consideration is that, of course, we have no Speaker of the House. And you'll remember from American government classes back in high school that the Congress controls the purse. So as long as there is no Speaker of the House, it's going to be very difficult for new appropriations to move forward. Having said that, there are certainly a lot of other options for getting weapons to the Israelis, as Rajiv mentioned, and I'm sure that the U.S. is kind of in a no-holds-barred mode of transacting in terms of providing weapons over to the Israeli military, to the IDF at this moment. So there will be workarounds for sure. So excellent question, excellent consideration. We need to think hard and we need to speak up.
Let's go to Tony in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, what is your question?
Good morning. As soon as we get a Speaker of the House seated, we're going to be back into two proxy wars, one with Ukraine and one with Israel. If China starts making a move on the Straits of Taiwan and we have to get into three proxy wars, and if we can't do that, we can't afford it, if we can't, who do we throw under the bus and suspend aid to? Which proxy war is the most important to American interests?
Beth, what do you make of those dynamics of U.S. interests when there are when there's wars and conflicts around the world?
Yeah, that's a really important consideration. And I think, you know, there also is growing inequality here at home. I know there are a lot of public schools that are hurting right now. There are a lot of roads and bridges that could sure use repair. There are a lot of demands on our communities to provide for example, for immigrants who are being, crossing the border and coming up to the U.S. And we've got a lot of things on our plate here at home. And there is a sense in which, as your caller suggests, becoming overcommitted in terms of our overseas expenditures and our overseas projections of power and military might is a real risk. So I think I take that to heart. I think that there's something to think about there. And in terms of throwing someone under the bus, I hate to see it in those terms. I'm not sure that this will be that kind of trade-off. And unfortunately, we're seeing it's the Palestinians who are being thrown under the bus right now. And I think that should really, we should concentrate our attention on trying to stop the violence and trying to find a way to move forward diplomatically in this really difficult, it was a very, very challenging situation.
Northwestern University Political Science and Religious Studies Professor Beth Shackman-Hurd, you can join in 800-642-1234 with your questions and comments. Beth, turning to settlements and residential communities on the land Palestinians want for their own country, I mean, Israeli policy allows these settlements in Palestinian territories. Are these policies contributing to this new conflict?
Yes. Unfortunately, we've seen a government in Israel and support for a government in Israel that is taking a very broad definition of what Israel is and should be in territorial terms. So in terms of land, they want to expand the land that they hold, and they are continually inching forward and gradually, one olive tree at a time, one Palestinian home at a time, they are aggrandizing, they're building out the Israel project, and they're building out the state of Israel and slowly taking over these lands, despite the fact that this has been condemned by international law and the international community for decades. This is not new. And so the settlements have been expanding, and there is a sense, like I said, of desperation, of fear, and of really this is kind of the end of the road, I think, for a lot of Palestinians. They feel like they're being crushed. And so it is horrific, but not surprising to see the backlash against Israel and these desperate and horrific attempts to wreak havoc in Israel on civilians as a way of calling attention to the Palestinians' plight.
Even before these new military operations, American authorities doubted a two-state solution to this conflict. Do you agree with that skepticism?
I do. This is a contentious issue, and it raises a lot of other issues that it would be difficult to get into given the time at hand, mm-hmm. Kate. Mm-hmm. But I would just say that it seems to me that the traction and the momentum behind a two-state solution has come into question. That used to be kind of the default position. We've got each side, each party needs its own state. And it does seem increasingly unrealistic. And I think some people would really like to see a binational state, a state in which there is democracy and equality and representation for all citizens, regardless of their background. In this region, and perhaps some kind of international governance or oversight of the holy sites that belong to many of the different traditions, including Christianity. A lot of Christian holy sites in this region as well, as you know. Mm. And so there needs to be, we need to imagine a completely new way of governing this region and of bringing the people together to find a way to govern this region democratically. I don't think that we can go on much longer as it stands. I think both sides are just suffering way too much.
In our last moments together, what do you have your eye on? What are you watching for next?
That's a great question. A couple of things. In the very short term, I'm watching the Rafah Gate, which is the crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. There are hundreds of trucks with humanitarian aid ready to enter into the Gaza Strip outside that gate. Israel has been bombing the gate. We need to see that that gate gets opened and that the aid gets through. And at the same time, that some of the people who are in terrible condition are evacuated immediately into the Sinai to get the care and help that they need. This mm-hmm. includes the foreign nationals, so all of the Americans and everyone else who are near that gate. Longer term, please.
Sorry. We're out of time, Beth. Thank
okay.
you so much for
no
joining
worries.
Us. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Always a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Beth Shackman-Hurd, professor and chair of religious studies and a professor of political science at Northwestern University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.